Well, the main cause of my anxiety has been getting ready for this evening, actually. But I'm really, really glad that you guys are here. And yes, it is my birthday. Some years, my wife likes to organize me a little surprise party. And it's been a little bit of an ongoing thing for us. And she always gets me as well, because I just don't think about these things. And but this year, I was kind of thinking, maybe this is some elaborate scheme. I was like, that would be utterly amazing, and also very ironic that she would make me suffer in this way, preparing for an evening like this. But it is really, really such a pleasure to be with you guys and to speak into this subject. I want to dive right in, and obviously the reason why we're all here is that we know that anxiety is on the rise. It's on the rise generally in society. And I suspect many of you identify with that on a very personal level. Apparently, back in the 1980s, something like 4% of Americans had anxiety-related mental disorder. Today, it's closer to 50%. And in Britain, they expect that something like a third of Britons will experience anxiety disorder at some point. And we're talking there at a medical level, not even just your ordinary day-to-day experience of anxiety, which you all are familiar with. And I certainly have known this anecdotally, known it through conversations with friends, people in and around my life. And talking about my wife, she's a GP, she will testify to the fact that she has an unbelievable number of particularly young men coming to see her with anxiety as the cause of whatever's going on in their life. So we know this is true. We know it's on the rise. We also know it's a huge problem. Anxiety makes you miserable, doesn't it? And if for no other reason, that's why we want to deal with it. It makes others miserable. I think anxiety is a little bit like sexually transmitted diseases. And the more of it there is around, the more likely you are to catch it. And apparently there's something to do with your mirror neurons in your mind, that if people are anxious around you, it's more likely you'll be anxious. So it makes us really unhappy. It makes other people unhappy. It makes us unhealthy. And I'm sure many of you will have experienced this on a personal level, you know, but just a really tragic story that relates to this was that some years ago, again, when my wife was in a hospital ward, there was a patient. She had the unfortunate job of delivering the news to this patient that he had cancer and that he had about 6 months left to live. And in that moment, the panic of the anxiety of facing death so gripped him that he died in front of her within 2 or 3 minutes. And it traumatized my wife for some time after that. It was a total shock, just out of the blue. And it shows you what a potent thing anxiety is and how it actually can wreck and ruin our lives. It makes you perform worse in many aspects of your life. It can really derail you. There's an author called Scott Stossel who has written a book about his own experiences of anxiety. He said, it's a fact. I say this from experience that being severely anxious is depressing. Anxiety can impede your relationships, impair your performance, constrict your life, and limit your possibilities. And the problem is that in telling you all these things, it compounds the problem, doesn't it? Because now you're not just anxious, but you're actually anxious about being anxious. You're like, this thing is going to ruin my life. So I want to begin with the question, why are we living in an anxious age? Why is it that anxiety is growing? And I want to give you a high-level flyover to begin with of some of the big causes of anxiety before I step back and analyze that, certainly from a Christian perspective, and give you a little bit of insight from that point of view. I've got to say, before I get into this, that the issue is unbelievably complex. It's not really possible to do any of it justice in a talk, and even for anyone to fully understand it, nobody really knows what's going on, that people are giving their best guesses at this. And also, obviously, there are tons of personal factors that are at work that are true for you, which it's impossible for us to unearth. And some of it's even genetic. but there's also other factors to do with your experiences, childhood, all these kinds of things. But what I want to do is give you a quick flyover of some of the big things. And I want to talk to you, first of all, about these three big changes at a societal level that have brought about this upsurge of anxiety in our day and age. And this is from my surveying of books and of the literature that I've been able to get my hands on to understand this as best as I can. And I think three things help us get somewhere in explaining this. The first is changing lifestyles. Changing lifestyles. A lot has changed in the way we conduct our day-to-day lives. We, give me a few examples. We sleep less than we used to and than we should. I think Britons sleep about 6.8 hours a night on average, and some of you Londoners are thinking that is luxury when you should be sleeping something closer to 8 hours a night, as you know. And obviously sleep massively affects your sense of well-being. You see me, if I've not slept enough, I'm pretty bleak, I tell you that. We sleep less than we should. We're not moving our bodies as much as we should. We need to exercise to feel good. These are things you all know. We're getting less sunshine than we should. And of course, the sunshine affects your lowers your blood pressure, reduces the sense of the blues. One book talks about this as advising people to have ecotherapy, which is just a very fancy way of saying just go outside, people. And we're working longer hours. We're always on. So these are some of the broad lifestyle things which have begun to crop up and which have bitten into our experience of fulfillment on a day-to-day basis. And one of the questions that I ask is, well, why are these changes happening? Why are our lives changing in these ways? And probably you could count dozens of explanations, but one obvious target that is worth just pointing out is, of course, the biggest change that's taken place within our generation, which is the rise of the internet and of the smartphone more latterly. And it causes all of the above factors. These things keep you awake, they keep you sedentary, they keep you indoors, and they keep you working. And obviously there is a poisonous concoction at work in this, and that the best minds on the planet are at work to keep you addicted to these things, which have it's now being recognized, a detrimental effect on your sense of joy and well-being on a day-to-day basis. There's an invasive aspect to what's going on in our day and age with the internet and with our smartphones, and we know this. I did a little bit of calculation recently in an article that's coming out in a couple of weeks for Salt, that you know the average person is spending 4 hours a day on their phone if you measure screen time. If you do the maths and figure what that is, 4 hours a day from the age of 21 to the age of 65, that amounts to the equivalent of 35 years of your professional life, if you work 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, being spent on your phone, which is a phenomenal thing. You can go away, do the maths later, and check it out for yourself. I promise you it is correct. So Cal Newport, I really enjoy his writing. I've been following his blog for a little while now, and he just released a book which is undoubtedly going to be a huge seller called Digital Minimalism. And he tells a little story. He says that he met the head of mental health services in a prominent university in the States a few years back. And she told him that normally she was used to seeing the same old issues, homesickness, a little bit of OCD for some of the students, eating disorders, depression, and that she'd seen a huge change that happened almost overnight with the students coming into her campus. And put it like this, she said, then everything changed. Seemingly overnight, the number of students seeking mental health counseling massively expanded, and the standard mix of teenage issues was dominated by something that used to be relatively rare, anxiety. And Cal Newport, who has made it his life ambition to get us offline, even though he's a computer scientist, he said, look, this is the connection. I don't know if any of you saw the article by the wonderful sociologist Gene Twenge called Have Smartphones Destroyed a Generation, which is one of the most clickbaity titles I've ever seen, but she's a brilliant writer. And she said this, she said, around 2012, I noticed abrupt shifts in teen behaviors and emotional states. The gentle slopes of line graphs became steep mountains and sheer cliffs. In other words, the gentle slopes of the trends of the way generations change. She said it suddenly became steep mountains and sheer cliffs, and many of the distinctive characteristics of the millennial generation began to disappear. In all my analyses of generational data, some reaching back to the 1930s, I had never seen anything like it. And she's talking about the sharp increase in mental health issues, and of course anxiety is right at the center of those swirling issues. And, you know, this is our first thing, changing lifestyles. And I think this is an important thing to take note of. I think this is in many ways the easiest win as well, because all of the factors I've talked to you about are pretty much in your control. I know, speaking for myself, I've been very deliberate about these things and cut almost all social media out of my life. I follow about 10 or 12 accounts on Twitter, and that's it for me. Including WhatsApp, which was one of the great joys of my last year, was to delete WhatsApp off my phone, and to the great annoyance of everyone around me, especially my family. But I got sick of all the groups, and you know, I don't mind you contacting me personally if it's relevant to me, but I don't need to hear what's going on all the time. And so I agree with Cal Newport. He put it like this. He said, simply put, humans are not wired to be constantly wired. I love that sentence. I think he's exactly right. However, with all that said, I don't think the rise of anxiety actually predated the ubiquity of the internet and also the creation of the smartphone. So this isn't going to get us the whole way in understanding this issue. Changing lifestyles is one thing, though, and it is an important thing to log in your mind. Here's a second thing. Changing relationships. One of the biggest growing factors as a cause of anxiety in our day and age that is recognized is the loneliness epidemic, the reality of isolation in modern life. And we know it's become an epidemic because only a couple years ago, the government appointed a minister for loneliness. And I don't think that was just for the sort of sad situations of elderly people in isolation, but even for those younger people, people looking out on you and thinking our generation are experiencing this. We know that it's causing a huge problem for us. And one of the great questions we've got to ask is why are we experiencing loneliness and isolation today at an acute and dangerous level? And I don't think you have to look very far to understand what's going on. I'll mention a couple of things which jump to my mind. One is the tendency to separate ourselves from our communities. This has been a trend over recent decades. And in many ways, it explains what I'm looking out on in this room. Our church, as well on a Sunday, is largely made up of singles in their 20s who have moved to London from other places. I know some of you are native Londoners, but you're in the minority, right? Most of us have come from elsewhere. We've detached ourselves from our communities and placed ourselves into a great city. And I love London. I'm very for London, and I love the excitement of meeting new people all the time. But I also see the disconnect that has happened in a generation in which we are willing to turn our backs for the pursuit of independence and satisfaction, turn our backs on community. So Jean Twenge, she says in her understanding of the changes across generations, she says that millennials are less likely to join clubs, community organizations, see friends for dinner, or know their neighbors. And she writes, the sadness of being alone is often the flip side of freedom and putting ourselves first. When we pursue our own dreams and make our own choices, which, by the way, is the hallmark of the millennial mindset onwards, she says, when we pursue our own dreams and make our own choices, that pursuit often takes us away from friends and family. And she's absolutely right, isn't she? So there's been a drive to separate ourselves from community. And I think with that as well, one of the things many of you will immediately recognize is the struggle to find anything like a lasting romantic relationship that, you know, previous generations settled down much, much earlier. And again, this can be charted on graphs where you can see how quickly people settled down into marriage. That isn't happening in our day and age. And again, Jean Twenge commented on this in her book Generation Me, when she said that the cycle of meet, date, fall in love, break up is, in her words, a formula for anxiety and depression. And when she wrote that, which was about 10 years ago, it's already out of date, isn't it? Because that isn't the cycle that's going on these days. We've actually given way to the hookup scene, which is an even more superficial and potentially, I believe, more damaging way of seeking love and intimacy. So we have these problems going on at large, and we recognize immediately that loneliness is a massive problem that actually touches many of us. Related to this, by the way, a guy called Will Hutton wrote in The Guardian a couple of years ago, he was talking about anxiety. He said, "This is an era when everyone is expected to find their personal route to happiness at the same time as the bonds of society, faith, and community, tried and tested mechanisms to support well-being, are fraying." I thought that was a perfect analysis of the current situation we're in, that we view ourselves as individuals going about life seeking our own personal joy and satisfaction at the same time that we have abandoned all of the structures of community, including faith, that previously gave us stability in life. And maybe as well, just because this is a pet subject for me, maybe we can point a bit of a side point here at the problem of social media, where it plays into this and changing relationships. Many of you know what a terrible substitute it is to genuine contact, face-to-face relationships, and plays into and exacerbates the issue of loneliness in our day and age, that we try and find companionship and friendship through our screens in a way that really doesn't satisfy. And I thought, just tell you one little more quote from Jean Twenge, because I really found this so insightful. She said, "It's almost as if this generation is starving for affection. We're malnourished from eating a junk food diet of instant messages, Facebook posts, email, and phone calls, rather than the healthy food of live in-person interaction." And that was, again, 10 years ago, so it's even out of date now. But she went on to talk about how there was a rising popularity for what they call cuddle parties, which is where people dress up in their pajamas and have non-sexual cuddles on the couch with a cuddle lifeguard there to watch you and make sure nothing dodgy happens. I thought, this is an incredible development in the history of humankind. We've never needed this before. So we have changing lifestyles. We've got changing relationships. Here's a third sort of high-level issue that we can understand has changed our lives, and it's this: changing circumstances. And what I mean by that is that, in some ways, you can see that life is getting more difficult. I mean, Jeremy mentioned one of the big issues of our day, which is, of course, Brexit. For us, that's a huge issue. There's been economic upheaval and uncertainty, and I was skeptical about this, but reading around the subject, apparently this is objectively true, that our generation is worse off, certainly than our parents were, and I'm talking, you know, millennials on compared to baby boomers who preceded them, and we have more debt, lower pay, less likelihood of owning a home, and so on. And these are kind of circumstantial threats to your well-being, aren't they? We can talk also about how the job market is more competitive than it used to be. And your degree, unfortunately, is worth less than it would have been previously. I'm sorry about those of you who've running up massive debts with your degrees. And this is particularly bad for our generation. And I'm speaking again about millennials, because we've been brought up to believe that we could be or do anything. And that's a mindset that sociologists actually have measured and recognized as a characteristic of people born in this particular generation. Brought up to believe you could be or do anything. And the reality is that your expectations of life do not match reality. There's a quote from Fight Club, where Tyler Durden, the Brad Pitt character, says it like this. He says, "Our generation has had no Great Depression, no Great War. Our depression is our lives. We were raised on television to believe that we'd all be millionaires, movie gods, rock stars, but we won't, and we're starting to figure that out, and we're very, very pissed off. And, you know, just see, again, my wife tells me that that it's been measured, there's been a sharp rise in the number of 40-something-year-old men who are going to their doctors to seek a diagnosis of autism in order to explain their disappointing performance and success in life. I thought that's a fascinating insight into how our expectations of what we want our life to look like do not match the reality because of the circumstances we're in. And then you add into this whole issue the fact that the world is looking increasingly polarized and broken, isn't it? I think just two words can summarize immediately the sheer panic that we're facing, and those words are Donald and Trump. And we're also worried, aren't we, about climate change and plastic in the ocean and all these kinds of things. All of this stuff is important. And what it does is it creates a sense that we're in danger and that there are threats around us that we can't control. And it's exacerbated by the media and it's exacerbated by social media. And so, where I've got to at this point is just to try and outline for you these areas that are real things, measurable things that people are writing about and noticing about our generation. These lifestyle changes, what was the second one? The changes in relationships and the changes in circumstances. And so, in a sense, what you're seeing is a bit of a perfect storm. That if you wanted to design a world in which humans would experience anxiety on a day-to-day basis, what would you do? You would, first of all, deprive them of sleep, exercise, sunshine, and rest by keeping them wired. Then you'd separate them from genuine relationships and connection and physical affection. And then you'd tell them that the world is about to explode and there's nothing they can do about it. And suddenly, you know, you think, well, this actually goes a huge way to explaining something of the ways that we're experiencing a lack of peace and a disruption to our emotional health on a day-to-day basis. But, and you knew this was coming, I'm still not satisfied with those explanations. And the reason is that I think, well, let me give you one reason. I think every generation has faced incredible challenges to have to overcome. I think back just through my own family line. I had a great-grandfather who was at the Somme, the great bloody battle that happened in World War I, and somehow he survived, though millions died that day, but it haunted him for the rest of his life. Both my grandparents on the other side served in the Second World War. And my uncle was in the Falklands, and my parents lived through that time in the early 1990s where we had a massive economic crash. Interest rates flew up to about 15%, so if you owned a home, you were in massive trouble. My mum had to go out to work and work night shifts at Sainsbury's just to pay the mortgage through a season that was incredibly challenging. And I think, look, has there ever been a generation that hasn't faced hardship? What is it about us? What is it about this generation that in the face of some societal changes, we do not seem to be resilient enough to have peace in the face of tribulation and challenge? And I think what we need to do is, I think we need to take a step, even though I'm offering you simplified explanations already, I feel like we need to take a step back and think of a broader, what I want to call a kind of meta explanation for the huge rise, the rapid rise in anxiety that we're seeing in our day and age. And I would ask you the question, what if all of this is to a huge extent due to a loss of faith in our day? Because you can trace, can't you, the same graph that shows the rise in anxiety will show the increase in secularism and the abandonment of faith in our day and age. And I know many of you will immediately disagree with this, so I'm going to try and make my case. But I want you to, the way I see this as a key that fits all the locks. That it relates to everything I've said so far and offers an explanatory, has an explanatory power that in a sense it fits all the locks of what we're talking about. The Bible is largely about overcoming fears. Fear is a constant theme throughout the Bible. And it's the flip side to fear, the desired state of life, is what the Bible talks about as peace, or shalom is the Hebrew word. It means a well-being that touches every dimension of your existence, your relationship with God, your relationship with people, and your relationship with yourself. Why is it so important to look at this subject then? Because we live in a context where faith has largely been dismissed and discarded. And now I think we're scrambling to pick up the pieces with all the good that we've actually lost on the back of this. But I think that the situation is not hopeless. There's a Japanese art form called kintsugi. If I pronounce that wrong, anyone Japanese, tell me later. But what it is about, if you break pottery, it's possible to reform that pottery with a lacquer that is covered in gold dust. Have you ever seen one of these pots that's reformed, where all the cracks are healed with gold lines? And the piece that's created later can actually be more valuable than before it was ever broken. And I think in many ways, even if you think of the abandonment of faith in our day and age as like the shattering of pottery, in a sense, putting the pieces back together, you could end up with something that we value more than what was abandoned. My job then is just to convince you in the next few minutes that we made a mistake when we turned our back on faith. And that anxiety is a symptom that we need to pay attention to understand this deeper problem of what's going on. I don't know if you ever heard of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where he talked about our kind of psychological needs that create a sense of well-being in life. And it's drawn as like a pyramid shape, where at the base are the most basic needs you have, rising to the things you would ideally attain in life in order to have a perfectly fulfilled life. And it starts with physiological needs to do with food and shelter and water. Then safety, then a sense of belonging, then a sense of esteem, and finally what he calls self-actualization. And this is my point. We live in a day and age which by many measures is better than it's been for any generation that's ever lived on the face of the planet. And so in many senses we've attained all of these things that Maslow described in his hierarchy of needs, and yet the problem of anxiety is persisting. And if you think of that as a symptom, then it tells us that Maslow got it wrong. There's something missing from the picture in terms of what you and I need in order to experience well-being and happiness in our lives. And here, I think the answer is you've climbed the summit, you've looked at your life, you've said, I've got everything, and yet I'm unhappy, and yet I'm anxious. What is a symptom telling you? In my case, is that you need God. How does belief in God transform your experience of anxiety then? I've got to say, first of all, that being religious is not enough. If anything, adding religion to your life can make the problem worse. Many of you have known that through having grown up in faith, that it has all of its own neuroses and anxieties, doesn't it? Like, you just have a lot more stuff to worry about. The mere idea that you can just become religious and deal with anxiety is not good enough. And I want to say that up front because I think it will alleviate some of your worries already about where we're going with this. What I'd rather believe is that it's a very specific form of faith that has the impact of bringing peace to the deepest part of your soul. And I want to just give you three arguments for this, and particularly in favor of the Christian faith. The first is this, that it shows you how to live. Shows you how to live. In my reading for this talk, I became aware of this fit of what Christianity, what it teaches you about life and how that fits the problem of anxiety. Because I was reading particularly one book called The Anxiety Solution by Chloe Brotheridge, and it's a secular book. She's a therapist in London. She was outlining over a couple of chapters a bunch of cures for anxiety or suggestions to curing your anxiety. And reading through, what struck me was all of these ideas were secularized practices that had Christian origins. So let me give you some examples. She talked about, right up at the top of their list was this thing called scheduling worry time, where you write down your worries. And I thought, that sounds a heck of a lot like prayer. Because that is exactly what you do. That's what gets you to your knees in prayer. It's like, I have all these swirling concerns in my mind. I'm scheduling a time, an appointment with God to get it all out there. Another thing she mentioned was the importance of incorporating meditation into your life. Some of the oldest texts in the Bible advocate a form of meditation, and particularly prayerful meditation, as a way of experiencing God's peace. She talked about gratitude as a very important key for overcoming anxiety. I don't know if you've ever been to a Christian church, but we sing a lot. And part of the point of that is that worship is a form of, it's an emotional form of gratitude, an expression of gratitude. It's designed to be that. She talked about telling yourself affirmations, which actually, believe it or not, is at the very heart of the Christian faith. Not telling yourself affirmations, but understanding the affirmation of God, that you're loved. She talks about relaxation techniques. I thought the oldest relaxation technique in the world was the command for God's people to Sabbath, which is to take a day of rest each week. She talked about visualizing an anxiety-free life. For the Christian, that's heaven. And the meditation upon the future is, in fact, what sustains many Christians through the troubles of this life. And you can see that very evidently in the New Testament. What's the difference then between these two forms of overcoming anxiety? Well, I think, to me, the secularized versions are weaker and deficient. Let me give you an example. She talks about self-esteem. She advises this a visualization exercise in which you step out of yourself and talk and look at yourself and regard yourself through someone else's eyes. And she says, this is what you might see. You might see your smile, your amazing sense of humor, your unique style, your beautiful mind, and the quirks that make you the gorgeous, lovable woman that you are. This is working for me. It's great. But I think that esteeming yourself is inferior to what is at the heart of the Christian message, which is that you are esteemed by God, that you're loved by him. So let me give you another example. When she advocates gratitude, I think gratitude is a wonderful thing. I think it's very important and fundamental to your sense of well-being. I think that difference of perspective from discontentment to gratitude can utterly change your day. But it's deficient in a secular worldview, because who are you saying thank you to? Well, when she talks about surrendering and letting go, she writes, "These days, I try to practice surrender. Surrendering means letting go, allowing things to be as they are, and trusting that everything will work out." But I read that, and my first thought was, well, who are you trusting? And why would you assume that things are going to work out in a chaotic, random, naturalistic universe? What I'm trying to put before you is a case that within the Christian faith are all the resources you need. They've been there for the running millennium. They've done countless people good. And that casting this whole thing out actually was like being let loose at sea without an anchor, without direction, without a map. And it's as though we're having to relearn how to live well. It's a little bit like when I play Jenga with my daughter. My son is a very reasoned and considered person, so he'll play well, but she just goes right for the base layer, just rips those things out like she doesn't care. And I think in many ways that's what we did as a society at large when we discarded faith. We just smashed the thing down just to see what would happen. And now we're in the process of trying to figure out why our lives are crumbling and rebuild the whole thing. And this gets really serious, right? Because obviously there's untold damage that comes as a result of just experimenting at large with the way that society works. Jesus talked about this. He said, you've got two options in life. He said, you can either build your life on sand, or you can build it on rock. And he said, the test will be when trial and tribulations come, when suffering enters your life. That will be the test of the way you built. And he said, to build on rock is to build on me and my word. And to build on sand is to build elsewhere. So what I'm trying to make a case for you is that he showed us how to live, and that his way of living actually creates peace in and around you. I'll give you a few quick examples of this. He taught about the permanency of marriage and the non-desirability of divorce. Did you know that statistically most couples who experience unhappiness in marriage will come through that and be happy if they remain committed to each other for a 5-year period? The relevance is that, you know, even in Jean Twenge's book, where she's looking at societal data on a great level, she says one of the huge causes for anxiety in people is the experience of their parents going through divorce. Not to mention, of course, the anxiety it produces in the parents themselves. And it's just one example. Look, when you live God's way, your life ultimately has an order to it that it works. What about Jesus teaching on forgiveness? I believe that a huge amount of the problems that we experience in mental health issues in our day and age are rooted in, often in, our inability to forgive. It's a very potent force for good in your life. We were in South Africa at the same time that Nelson Mandela died. We happened to be in Johannesburg, and the tributes that poured out from people were deeply moving, because what he showed the world and what his message showed the world, his policy of forgiveness showed that you could have peace and the removal of anxiety from a situation of deep tension in the mid-90s when his party came to power. And where does he get that from? It's actually from the Bible. It's actually from Jesus himself. Think about how Jesus taught about the danger of worshipping money. How much of anxiety in your life would be removed if you could do away with the disproportionate desire for money? It's not that you don't need the stuff, you do. But the Bible talks about the command to Sabbath, to rest, and so much anxiety stems from our feeling that we are in control of the world and we can't stop working because otherwise things will crumble. And there is a beauty in rest where actually you're handing it over to God. That's the purpose of Sabbath rest. We could go on, and I just want to move on to the next point here. So it shows you how to live, and that living works. It creates peace in you and in your environment when you live well. Here's the second thing, and I think it's even more important. The Christian faith shows you how to trust. It's actually at the very heart of what it means to have faith. Anxiety at its root is a control problem, isn't it? You don't know what's going to happen, and you definitely can't control what's going to happen. If you could, you wouldn't be anxious. It is by definition a control problem. What do you do in that situation? I actually think that this is, again, to think of anxiety as a symptom, I think this is a kind of cosmic insecurity that we all feel when we don't know God. And the secular world in which we live will offer you one of two alternatives of how to deal with this problem of uncertainty and insecurity about the future. On the one hand, you can adopt the kind of, well, you could think of it as the Pumbaa approach to life. You know, Hakuna Matata, what a wonderful phrase. It means no worries for the rest of your days. And essentially, it's the kind of, it's the ability to tell yourself that it's all going to work out and just relax. And there's certain measure of power in that, but it's also a form of denial, isn't it? Because you're denying the reality that there are problems in the world and that you will confront problems in your life. And the flip side to that is, the other alternative is that you attempt to take control. You double down on the fact that you're not in control by attempting to take control. You ever heard the poem Invictus, which is it's loved the world over? And the last verse of it goes like this. It says, "It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishments the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul." The only problem is that it is utterly untrue. I struggle to master my fate on a daily basis, never mind on a grand, the grand scale, just getting out of bed in the morning or these kinds of things are difficult enough to master. I'm not the master of my fate. And so that's another form of denial. It's a denial of your limitations, of the fact that you will have high-level failures in life that will utterly destroy aspects of your hopes and dreams. And the ultimate thing you can't control is, of course, death. Is there another way? There is. You have to know someone who is in control, and you have to be able to trust that person. And of course, I'm talking to you about what it means to have a relationship with God. And one of the reasons why God has been rejected has been the fact that we don't want to be controlled by someone else or to be told what to do. We want freedom. I have two brothers, and one of them, my older brother, ever since we were kids and even to this day, continues to be one of the people I love the most and who annoys me the most in the whole world. Anyone with an older brother will immediately know what I'm talking about. And part of the reason is because he just thinks he knows best about everything, and he likes to tell me how to live my life. And I'm like a grown man now, and it just doesn't make sense anymore. So I'm like, seriously, you're still doing this? And it's annoying. It's really annoying, and I sometimes find myself resenting that. But I also have to admit, my brother knows a thing or two. He happens to be a double consultant in anesthetics and intensive care. And just you'll permit me a moment of bragging, he happened to be the doctor in the intensive care unit when Sergei Skripal and his daughter came into the ward. And so he and his team were responsible for saving their lives in Salisbury last year. And I'm very proud of him. And so you imagine, as much as I don't like listening to him, let's say we're at a family gathering and I choke on a piece of turkey, I lunge forward, stab myself with my knife, knock over a glass of water and electrocute myself, which would be a very bad day. If in that moment my brother is there and he knows what to do and he's in control, the anxiety goes out of the situation. And my point is this, that as much as we buck against having someone who is over us, the reality of our weakness and smallness and our limitations ought to elicit from within us a gratitude that there is someone greater than us who we can turn to and have we can trust in. And I'm not, again, talking about a vague general notion of a higher power. I don't think that will do you any good. I'm not talking about the kind of vague ideas of spirituality which many people own. They say, I believe in a higher power, or I believe in a God, because that kind of a God is a God of your own invention, and a God of your own invention is no help when it comes to the real problems of life. I rather, and I say this confidently, what I'm rather talking about is the very specific answer that the God of the Bible gives to this problem of anxiety in the face of the cares of life, because you have to know one thing about the God you worship. You have to know that he's good. And that was settled once and for all in the fact that the Bible tells us about God giving the gift of his son, Jesus Christ, to save us, to be a kind of a sacrifice of atonement in our place. when he died on the cross. And for Christians, that forever seals the question whether God is good or not and means to do us good. You need to trust him. And this is the assumption behind what Jesus teaches about anxiety very specifically. You know, in Matthew's gospel, in the Sermon on the Mount, he says things like this. He says, talking about prayer, he says, your Father knows what you need before you ask him. In other words, it's the assumption that God is good and that he's a father that allows you to pray in a way that you feel peace. And so he goes on a few verses later and says, don't worry about anything. And he starts to be very specific about anxiety. But it's resting on the assumption, okay, that God is good and he's trustworthy. Here's the last thing I want to say, that Christianity also shows you how to be fearless. I believe that all of our fears and anxieties are basically rooted in one great fear, which is the fear of death. That might not make immediate sense to you, but the reality of your death actually looms over your life like a shadow and affects you in all kinds of ways that you may not even be conscious of and is at the root of all your other fears. I was reading not so long back about a study that had been conducted in America with some basketball players, and they divided them into two groups, and one of the groups, they got them to write about and think about death before they went on the basketball pitch. And what they measured, what they saw in those players was that they wrote that they took more shots, better shots, and they hustled more. I don't know what that means. And they ran faster. I think it's good. So they did more of that. And they ran faster. So in other words, these guys, they played better, I think is the bottom line. Scored more goals, you know, I'm sure whatever they say. Yeah. I'm kidding, I was right. These guys just couldn't help it, could they? All right, so, and what they call this, it's actually got a psychological term, they call it terror management. And they say that it's that people compensate for anxiety about dying by desperately finding ways to boost their self-esteem. Now, I wonder, and I'd say this with some real confidence, actually, that maybe all of life is terror management. And you think about specific anxieties that crop up for you. Think about the anxiety around singleness, that for many of you worry, am I going to be single for the rest of my life? You know, what gives that its acute pain is the knowledge that the clock is ticking. You know, if you could guarantee unlimited years ahead of you, you wouldn't be worried. You'd think, well, it'll happen in time. Actually, it's the knowledge of your mortality that makes that day-to-day experience of anxiety more acute. Well, think about the ways that so some of you suffer anxiety in work and performance. Underneath that, of course, is the awareness that you have a very small amount of time on this planet in which to prove your existence, to justify your existence. It's the knowledge of your death which actually steals joy in the present and creates an anxiety which you cannot handle. And not saying that every day we wake up afraid of death. It just isn't true, is it? What I am saying is it's the great fear which upholds all the other ones and makes them powerful in our lives, gives them a potency. And that's why I'm interested in the answer Christianity gives, because Christianity is a war on death. That's what it is. It starts with who Jesus is. The reason he died was so that we didn't have to die the death we deserve, a death that would result in judgment. The reason he was raised from the dead was, in the biblical language, so that he could be the firstborn from among the dead. In other words, the reality of his resurrection, the eyewitness testimony to that fact that it happened, is the great reason that Christians have confidence that our lives are not just simply snuffed out when we die. And what that teaches us is that if you can face down death, the greatest fear it puts all the other fears in your life into perspective, doesn't it? It makes them shrink. And so as much as I think you can learn a ton from, you know, my earlier analysis, not saying you learn it from me, I'm saying we can learn a ton about how to approach the challenges of life in the ways that I was describing of lifestyle, relationships, and circumstances, and figure out how to live better lives in view of that. I actually believe that Christianity offers us an answer, that it helps you live a life that works and creates peace in you and around you. It makes you secure in the deepest possible way to know that God loves you and that you can trust him. And it deals with the biggest fear, the fear of death.